Stuart, perhaps we could start by talking about a work you carried out at Gallery House in 1972 called ZL656395C.
Well, I was originally approached by Siggy Kraus, who had been given the job of running Gallery House, which became a gallery that was attached to the German Institute, Goethe Institute. And it lasted for about 2 years, and I was invited to open Gallery House at that time with two other artists, Mark Shumovitz and Gustav Metzger. And so in order to do that, we went to have a look at the spaces of Gallery House, and it was a large, I suppose, Victorian building in Exhibition Road in Southwest 7, quite near the top of the road, looking over towards the park, next to the German Institute. I was particularly interested in the ground floor, not the first room on the ground floor. You came in through the front door, very big front door, and immediately on the right-hand side was quite a large room, a bit shaped like a saucepan. You know, one would feel one was very much in the bottom of a saucepan. And then, if you came in through the door, past that room, and went in through the hallway, which was very broad and quite long, the stairs going up to the left, on the right-hand side there was a second room. And if one went into there, it was actually quite a small room, which as you went in off the corridor. And there was a curious sort of set of doors which then took one into another room. And in that second room, there were no doors, but there was a slit in the wall about eye level. It looked a bit like a letterbox without a flap. And one could look through that into the third room. And this, in fact, there were three rooms that had been sort of partitioned off, made out of one room, which was a very big one with two windows at the end. And I was particularly attracted towards this sort of division of rooms, as it were. And so I conceived of a piece of work which would take into account the movement of people in through the front door, along the corridor, in through this door, into the small room, then into the second room, and being able to look then through this letterbox-type shape into the third room. And it's now 8 years ago, and it's difficult to remember exactly what ideas I had in mind at that time. I seem to remember writing a proposal, some sort of proposition, which was in a sort of typewritten sheet that was handed out, in which it was stated that something like this: a man may occupy this room for a period of 17 days. He may order the circumstances of his living in such a way, or he may not. He may just allow things to happen and so forth. And the outcome of this has to be seen. And then there was a list of things that this figure wasn't going to do, what he was going to do, what kind of food he was going to eat, what kind of diet he was going to have, what kind of clothing he was going to wear, that sort of thing. And at the bottom, it said that none of this was assured. In other words, none of it was necessarily going to occur. It was a proposition that may or may not occur. And the title of the work was ZL656395C, which is one of the numbers that identifies me for administrative purposes, I presume. I've got a military number and a national insurance number and several other numbers, I suspect, attached to my, I'm seen in those terms in certain situations. So according to the National Insurance, I am ZL656395C. And so I decided that I would become that number. I would actually attach directly to myself for all intents and purposes, my name would be ZL656395C. So I went to see a solicitor, and a document, which unfortunately I've lost, was made up, in which I would become, from a certain period of time, and I can't remember the exact dates, for the length of time that I was going to be in that building, I would, my name would become ZL656395C. And I think at midday on the day that I started this work, a representative of the firm of solicitors came, and I was sworn in, as it were, as ZL656395C. Anyway, so I became that number for that time. As one went into the first room, this is how it was laid out, there were numbers of chairs that were laid out like a kind of dentist's waiting room or doctor's waiting room. And they were all upside down, and there was a certain amount of rubbish on the floor, cigarette butts, but nothing, I mean, just dust and cigarette butts and things. And if one went, everything was painted white, and just this sort of rather sleazy atmosphere of chairs that I... The metal chairs, they were all painted white, they had canvas. They were very old metal chairs, stacking chairs, but instead of having the sort of current plastic, they were made of, they had canvas. And there were about a dozen of those, I think. And then when one went into the second room, there was just painted in Roman lettering at about 2 inches on the wall, some way distant from the where you could look through that split in the wall into the third room, was there were just two words, "No reason," written on the wall. And then inside the third room, which is where I was going to live for 3 days, although there was a toilet elsewhere, and I didn't live entirely, as it were, in that room all the time. I went to the toilet downstairs and so forth, but the rest of the time I stayed there. There was some electrical equipment, some amplifier and a kind of a very primitive kind of sound synthesizer I had at the time, two speakers. And there was a kind of mechanical beat which was somewhat like a heartbeat. The room was sort of, paint was thrown all around the room, so it was blackish, dark grey, and the windows were painted and so forth. And as you well know, on paint on glass, it tends to, so there was a sort of streaky quality about, that reduced the light level a lot. And there was only natural light used in the room, so when it got dark, it got dark, and if it was a light outside, a good sunny day, then it would be relatively a good amount of light in the room. But if it was a dull day, well, in other words, one could really sense the change of light in the room because of the way it had been treated with the colour grey. The floor was sort of lino on the floor, and there was a lot of water and paint and so on, and was a rope, I think, at one stage which went across. And then there was a wheelchair that I had at the time that I sat in, and it really was a kind of it was a sort of test of survival in a way, and also a kind of, I mean, apart from all the obvious implications of it, that, you know, it was a reduction of the sort of human being, you know, the sense of the personality, of the individuality, to to a number, let's say. It was, but it was paradoxical, because it wasn't a protest against bureaucracy as such. It was really much more a protest against the kind of conspicuous individualism, which is another kind of conformity, which is much more insidious and much more difficult to combat, and sort of totalitarian in its effect. So that what it appeared to be was what it wasn't, and what the obvious reading of it was not what it was intended to be. I mean, which is a real problem with art, it seems to me, anyway. You know, the reading of or the interpretation of art is in a way according to the understanding and the demand of the viewer. to some extent, unless it's so overtly clear as to what it's about. And if it's so overtly clear, it quite often reduces its value as an art experience. So it had that sort of ambiguity about it. The use of myself or my own body at that time before and after as being like a figure, like being a human figure, but not necessarily being a specific person, which is, of course, a contradiction, because I am a specific person. But I attempted to reduce the sort of specificity of myself. I was in a sort of greyish all over and so forth as an image, and tried not to do anything, tried to do as little as possible, which, as anybody knows, if they've sat for any length of time doing nothing, it gets, it's very difficult not to. One tries to escape from the reality that begins to impinge. I had a feeling of being a person, a figure of importance, attempting to do as little as possible, which is again a kind of contradiction of the notion of the director or the person in power, who also does as little as possible, but is in the position of power and directs what shall be done, but actually doesn't do very much. So it had that aspect to it as well. In that sense, it was anti-hierarchical and anti-social in the sense of the kind of social structure that we, in relation to the kind of social structure that we experience and so forth. And then, of course, there were all the difficult things that happened through the work, which was, the psychological effect on me of that long period of time, and the kind of reactions that I had to being, that I experienced being in that situation, which I hadn't taken into account at all. I couldn't take into account, because I hadn't experienced anything like that before. The kind of movements I made, kind of repetitive movements I made, a kind of paranoia, a sort of paranoia or fear that built up, because I could, for example, I could hear people coming from the front door, more or less. I could hear them coming along the corridor, coming into the room. I could hear them coming into the opening doors and so forth. And then I could see a face, part of a face, look through the slit. And it was a bit like being in prison, because the restriction of the slit, every face began to look like the same face. And then towards the end, about an hour before the end, I stopped the work quite deliberately, because I, for some reason, I felt that it couldn't finish. It had to be broken. It shouldn't finish within the terms that I had actually organized it. It had to be a failure. And in order for it to be a failure, I actually stopped it 55 minutes, I think, before the end. And then, because I'd said in the very first piece, it's not assured that this will take place. None of it, was it true? Was I there for 17 days? Was I actually having was I going on a diet? Did I move out of the building? Was I there at night? Because the building was shut at 8 and it opened again at 10 or something. Were all those things true or weren't they true? So there was no way of really knowing as to whether this was actually taking place or not. And the question after that to ask was it important that I was there or not there? Was the substance of the work, did the work carry because of the intent, because of the appearance and the image and so on and so forth, rather than the actual carrying out? What in fact made it a work or made it not a work? So I didn't want to fulfill it in that sense. I was perfectly capable of doing it, because we're only an hour to go. But I decided to. I wrote on the wall, "Not achieved," and the time. And then I pulled down the partition between myself and the other people, and just stayed in the room. And those people who then came in that last hour before it was over, came in, and they either looked at it and went out, or they came right into the room, and we talked and so on. And then it was over.
I was interested in one thing you mentioned about that piece of work, i.e. the protest element was not only, or maybe wasn't necessarily to do with the reduction of a human being to a number, but the opposite almost of this obsessive requirement, particularly within art, to become independent and unique and an individual.
I've been perhaps sensitive, or maybe even oversensitive, to the problem that occurs when with live activity, that if one presents oneself, or let's say one has to present oneself as being the vehicle through which ideas are, you know, being, or expressions are being developed. The most obvious and, in my view, one of those superficial readings of that is that one is therefore an egoist, which is in fact the more or less the antithesis of the intention of the work. And because of the sort of obsessive read, or not exactly obsessive reading, but what appears to be become an obsession, if you like, with individuality, with the individual, with particularity, which occurs elsewhere all the time, sort of elevation of the individual as over and above the social group and all of that, you know, whatever that, what that represents. I've been particularly sensitive about being, that my work is being seen like that, when in all the time I've been using myself to develop, if you like, to project notions about conditions, you know, which are to do with groups rather than individuals, and certainly to do with but at the same time to do with putting myself in a position of risk, as it were, you know, that by actually taking the chance to use myself and to place myself in those circumstances, then I'm making a certain kind of commitment to whatever ideas I attempt to project through using myself in that way. And that's been a very important aspect of the work that I've tried to do. Now, that's actually becoming less important at the moment, but then it was very important. So I found myself in a contradictory situation of being reviewed, let's say, or looked at, described as an egoist, which seemed to me to at the time to be extremely perverse reading of the situation. I understand that a little more now as to why that would be, because I think the ideas that I was attempting to carry were in fact critical of the society or aspects of the society, and I think that that many journalists or many people who were in the position of, shall we say, public journalism were and are actually not about engaging in those issues through the medium of art. Although there's been a certain change of climate since I was doing those works. At that time, that was how it was, or that was how it seemed to me. And I found it very difficult. I found it actually quite disturbing in a way, you know, to be continually treated as an eccentric figure. Whereas it seemed to me absolutely sane, if you like, to use oneself to carry ideas.
If one focuses on the issues, but was live work important to you because of its impact and close engagement with a specific group of people?
Well, at I when I started it, I suppose like a lot of like most sort of people engaged, you know, as artists, I went into things, jumped in at the deep end, and then found out what the water was like, and hoped that, you know, something would come out of it. And when I started live work, it was very much to do with dispensing with middlemen, you know, to actually become to work directly with a group of people. And that there was sort of, I suppose, a kind of notions of sort of being egalitarian, if that's the right word, I'm not sure that it is, but to... It dealing with notions of equality, you know, equality for myself as much as anybody else, you know, that I didn't hand over a product to a middleman who would then use it in, you know, whatever way he felt, you know, was most appropriate for it in terms of his interest or her interest. So it was much more to do with actually having the freedom to do what I wanted with what with what I had, what I made. So in order to do that in as direct a way as possible, I was able to do away with the object and deal with behavior or relations between myself and other people. Now that actually didn't answer any number of questions that I thought it might have. But it did actually answer a few. It actually did put me on a front line, in a front line position, and therefore gave me the opportunity to present my activity to stand or fall in relation to other people, but only for a short period of time, with them directly there. At one stage, I was thinking of my work and as all being they're all propositions which. They were all attempts. I didn't see them as being failures or successes. I saw them really as taking different issues, social situations, different circumstances, different contexts, and sometimes being invited, sometimes being offered, sometimes getting them myself, and making propositions in relation to those specific contexts, but always dealing essentially with the same kind of central issue, which was the actual relationship between myself and those people, dealing with the problem of class, idea, you know, class structures, inequality, etc., etc. So that the expressions which come out quite ambiguous and quite often misread in any number of ways or read in all different sorts of ways were to me dealing with those kinds of problems in those different specific situations, which is why, for example, when I went to Peter Lee on that to do this a project in the mining community, there was no, I didn't involve myself in performance at all, live work at all. It had, because of the specific context, I needed to do something else, but it was still about that kind of problem of hierarchy, social systems and so forth, or social structures. So that when one, if one looked at the different kind of approaches that I made, quite often they appear to be quite different from, say, that position to that position. But that's only because of my limited understanding of that situation as opposed to that, what I thought I could do there as opposed to there, or what I found I had to do there because of the situation I was in there. But all the time around this one central theme, you know, which sort of keeps cropping up time and time again. And maybe that theme, which you've described as the, you know, the individual in relation to groups of people and so on, or groupings, or and also in relation to social division and so on, is what I tend to sort of be I'm very conscious of, you know, to the point that I am conscious of it in the all the work that I do, you know, whether it be as an artist working in an institution like the Hayward, or you know, in somewhere that nobody knows particularly about, or the street, or in education, or wherever. It seems to be that in any kind of social circumstance, one bumps into that in Britain. One bumps into that kind of social hierarchy. And therefore, it becomes the theme of my work, very, very much so. Because I actually have views, I have feelings and views about it. I experience it. And, you know, I strongly react against it in various ways.
What about the piece you did at the Haywood, where you were outside of the building, which would be quite consistent with this idea of being both outside yet within?
That was the first Haywood annual. It's interesting, whenever people talk about that, my work is never mentioned. It's as almost as though it never took place. I mean, the main arguments are about what went on internally. I mean, Peter Blake and Peter Fuller, for example. You know, that the kind of live work is just wiped out yet again. It's very interesting, that. I find it rather... I'd really... It would be interesting to look at, you know, those... Whenever, you know, that kind of live work, whosoever it is actually placed in those sort of high cultural areas, you know, to what extent it's sort of related to. I think it's quite often sort of put there, you know, as a kind of liberal gesture on the part of people who, you know, who want to sort of open up the whole question of art, right, within those institutions. Anyway, so my first suggestion was not to be there at all. I mean, I decided that I would accept it. I hadn't worked in England. I'd done something at the Battersea Arts Centre, a day's work, but I hadn't done anything in England since 1973 in Liverpool. So it was then 1977. So I thought, well, it's an opportunity, although it's difficult because of I always disliked very much that whole atmosphere of Royal Festival Hall and then the Haywood being built and the National Theatre and so forth. It seemed to me to be really quite... it didn't seem to reflect any sort of live atmosphere as to, you know, as to what cultural activity might be about. It seemed to me to be the reverse. Everybody knows this. They're like bunkers, that things are sort of hidden inside, and one really wonders what the function of those buildings is. I mean, are they going to double as nuclear fallout shelters or what? I mean, what are they? So I said, yes, I would do it, but I wanted to do it in a shop, somewhere like in Waterloo, or I wanted to get out of that area. And they said, well, no, you can't do that. So I said, well, in that case, I'd like to work outside. And I was given the opportunity of, you know, working on the balcony. And so I had a good look at the balcony and so on, and I decided to work, to actually develop the work from the window outwards into the balcony, as it were, so that anybody coming up the stairs and then coming, you know, along that bit just around by the stairs in Haywood could look out onto the balcony, and they would look, as it were, into the work. That would be one way of being involved with the work. So I painted the windows outside with mud. I was using mud, I mean, for several reasons, but one would be to sort of like sully the monument and close down the window. You can still imagine looking through the window. It's like looking into clouds, really, down to the point where it then focused on a kind of almost a tunnel thing, and then I started to build a structure out from the window into the balcony, as it were, across the balcony. And the work involved this rather heavy wooden structure, which we worked on so many hours in the day, and then we went through certain two basic performances, as it were. There was a lot of water involved, paint was involved, and clay, so that there was a kind of the basis, the sort of floor of the structure and of the activity had this appearance of being unstable, wet water, quite maybe up to 2 or 3 inches deep, soapy, muddy, very tactile, and so on. And essentially unstable, and the structure coming off the balcony, out into the balcony, being quite rigid and, in a way, reflecting in a different sort of way the kind of architecture that was around, and then to place, there were two of us working, to place a figure in that structure every day to suggest, if you like, a kind of disassociation, alienation, sense of being nowhere, nowhereness, which I felt very strongly in that whole atmosphere of that environment, which seems to me to be desperate. And those two behavioural actions took two forms. One was suspending a figure by strings to his clothes, so that it was suspended rigidly within the structure, but not supported by any tangible, any floor or expected support, but only by the incidentals of its, that its outer surface. That took various forms, standing up, sitting, eventually laying right out about 20 feet up, just hanging by strings above this great hole in this structure. And the other thing was to actually suspend the figure upside down for short periods of time within the structure, so that one was making this kind of gesture about that in these kinds of circumstances, the image of the figure upside down is like that human stability doesn't exist, it's gone, and that one is at the mercy of whatever, like one's lost, there's no social structure, it's just a completely disassociated condition, and that was the kind of substance of the work as it went on, finally culminating in the last act was the one figure hanging upside down nude, and black paint and white paint was put on it so that it took different sort of had a different sort of image. This happened actually all the way through, but it was at its sort of strongest the last 2 days, when the figure was hung by strings out like that, way above the whole thing, and the second one it was hung that way. And it was very much to do with the immediate environment, and which is, of course, is still there. It's going to be there for a long time. How are they going to knock it down? I mean, maybe I'm quite wrong in saying this, but I don't know. But my impression is that there is an element of privilege which exists, which is shown rather through the actual physical structure of the Haywood, but in relation to how it actually reveals itself, how it offers itself to people. That is, that if you really don't know that much about the South Bank and all the rest of it, where is the door that lets you in? I mean, if you're on Waterloo Bridge, for example, how can you get to the Haywood? Where is the door? There is no kind of front to the building, as it were. There's no obvious entry that enables people to say, ah, yes, that's the place I don't want to go to, or that there's the Haywood.
And I suppose in the same sense, the mechanisms that control that, as indeed nearly all other institutions, are also similarly concealed.
Yeah, well, I think there's an implication there for that. Mm. Therefore, you've got to... What it implies is, if it's true, that you've got to know about it. And to go further than that, I mean, the Haywood is one of those sort of public institutions that deals with a specific aspect of high culture. At the same time, you've got to know about it. Well, of course you have to know about it, because high culture, who is it for? I mean, who actually, if we talk about high culture, well, it's got to be for a specific kind of public. I think that, I was reading Stuart Hood's book on the media, I forget what it's called, and it's just been published, and it's very interesting, because it seems that...
it seems to make a lot of sense in relation to the sort of hierarchical systems that we have in relation to that art activity and so on. And I remember thinking, I could not, and it's still difficult for me to exactly rationalise why it is that, or why it was that the sort of the history of British art, shall we say, from that period that I have some experience of and commitment to, is a history which denies so much of my personal experience. I don't mean as an artist, but so much of my personal experience of artistic activity in general that was going on in Britain, and reinforces, like the so-called centre, painting and sculpture, it seemed to me that there was an underground, underground history, as it were, which has never been celebrated, never been. And I found it. Felt emotional about it. I couldn't rationalise it. And I think Stuart Hood, in his book on the media, actually points to very much to the way in which the structures which deal with repressive tolerance, actually operate, it becomes a lot clearer to me, and now I don't expect the future history of where we are at the moment to include activities that I personally feel committed to or understand, because those shall we say more lively, more exploratory activities outside of what they call the mainstream, they're the ones that actually aren't going to be celebrated. And it seems to me to be
unless the proviso is, of course, unless it's after the event when the real meanings have been subdued or lost. I mean, that's another irritating thing about history,
sure,
isn't it? It can incorporate once the guts has gone out of it.
Yes, but even that takes a long time. In relation to the field that I'm in, say something like futurist performance.
Yeah.
How much do we really know about that? I just happened to have read a book on it that somebody published very recently, which suggests that, that it's almost, that when the book was written it was almost too late. People are dead and so on and so forth. But it's not something that is actually in any way celebrated, in relation to futurism. I think also that we've got another thing, which is the other thing that happens to us, is that it must have been very interesting to have lived in the 19th century when Britain was, like a leader in the world, or the leader, the one with power, as it were. And now, we are we're shrinking so fast, almost to go out of sight and go through Alice's mirror and become something else. It's very curious to look at like the kind of imperialist cultural actions that are going on, that have been going on, like the American invasion from 1956 onwards, the German invasion from 1970 onwards, the way in which a lot of our thinking is inhabited with, colonial. We are colonized to a large extent in the cultural field, by those cultural activities which actually stem from countries with great political economic power in a capitalist sense. So it's the states that actually provides a tremendous input into Britain, it seems to me, culturally, or has done, until the Vietnam War. There was a period of crisis and so on, and it obviously changes its face and nature, especially with now, after 1970, there's the rivalry of the Germans in this respect.
Yeah.
And I feel that that we are heavily suppressed, as it were, you know, overlaid with a kind of cultural cultural power coming from those two sources. There doesn't seem to be much serious investigation, you know, into the nature of and the condition that we're in those kinds of terms. You know, you've only got to look at the new spirit of painting, whatever it is, right? I mean, it's another one.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not to say that every foreign exhibition that comes is necessarily going to, but certainly I think the Americans and the Germans have, you know, have demonstrated that on more than one occasion. Well, a lot. And you know, the commercial galleries, you know, like they have obvious, the connections are obvious and legion. You know, they, you know, like it was interesting when I went to that manifestation of in Amsterdam, Works and Words, which was a symposium really of artists from the Warsaw Bloc countries and Yugoslavia. The response by those, by individuals from those countries to being in Amsterdam, and the non-aligned Yugoslavs being incredibly aggressive, you know, about the cultural domination, cultural domination of the English language, very interesting, the refusal of some of them to speak English, the refusal to be seen in relation to Warsaw Pact country, which I think is absolutely right, but had been packaged, you know. In other words, they were demonstrating a certain sort of cultural aggression which came from the kind of social and political structures that they have in Yugoslavia, say, as opposed to Poland, you know, where individuals were coming out, making their individual expression and being happy to be able to do so. To the point where there was nobody coming out of Czechoslovakia, you know, they didn't make it.
Yeah.
And where Hungary, one made it or two made it, you know, and that was very interesting, that kind of situation, and their desperate, you know, the desperation, I mean, the control on Warsaw Pact countries is very heavy in another way altogether, and that I had a lot of sympathy for the Yugoslavs, you know, because in some senses, you know, that's really how it should be in England, you know, that we should be aggressive about cultural domination.